Blog Talk Radio.
All right, turn it up and stand back. You're about to feel our reach. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for
Hard Starboard Radio.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible.
Can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. When I hear that trumpet sound, I'm gonna rise right out of the ground. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. Well, look way down the river, and what do you think I see? I see a band of angels, and they're coming after me. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. Well, look down yonder, Gabriel. Put your feet on the land and sea. But Gabriel, don't you blow your trumpet till you hear from me. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. Jesus, meet me. Meet me in the middle of the air. And if these wings don't fail me, I will meet you anywhere. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. Well, meet me, mother and father. Meet me down the river road. And mama, you know that I'll be there when I check in, my Lord. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. You have to know, find a girl, settle down. If you want, you can marry. Look at me, I am old, but I'm happy. I was once like you are now, and I know that it's not easy to be calm when you found something going on. But take your time, think a lot. Why, think of everything you've got, for you will still be here tomorrow, but your dreams may not. How can I try to explain? When I do, he turns away again. It's always been the same. Same old story. From the moment I could talk, I was ordered to listen. Now there's a way, and I know that I have to go away. I know I have to go. Change, just sit down, take it slowly. You're still young, that's your fault. There's so much you have to go through. Find a girl, settle down. If you want, you can marry. Look at me, I am old, but I'm happy. All the time that I've cried, keeping all the things I knew inside. It's hard, but it's harder to ignore it. If they were right, I'd agree, but it's them they know, not me. Now there's a way, and I know that I have to go away. I know I have to go.
No, Jasmius.
Thank you.
positive. It's been since, well, last year, technically. December 23rd, 2017. Since we have been live together on the Hard Starboard Radio Network, blogtalkradio.com/HSR Network. I am, as I always am when I am available, your humble host, Jasmius, your ruler, your benevolent despot, your fountain rabbi of conservatism, constitutionalism, Christianity, common sense, your conservative Ronin. Ordinarily, Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific. For the record, call-in number 646-478-5068, although I will not be taking calls today, as you may have already guessed. Email address, jasmius@comcast.net. Follow me on Twitter at jasmius, capital J, capital A, capital S, lowercase M-I-U-S. And your repository for your education, edification, enlightenment, and entertainment in all your life's endeavors, youtube.com/hardstarboardradio. And if you hear me working on a cough drop, that's because I managed to catch the two colds, not one, but two, that Mrs. Hard Starboard and intern Gearhart brought into Hard Starboard Galactic headquarters over a week ago, but which I had not yet caught, to which I had not yet succumbed until, of course, I couldn't resist a romantic interlude with Mrs. Hard Starboard, and that's where I got her cold from. And no, she didn't give it to me. I I knew what I was risking, and came down with it. Although coldies have been somewhat effective in damping down the inevitable symptoms. But if you wonder why I'm sucking on a cough drop, that's because I want to get through this hour, this eulogy for my father, without exploding into coughing jags. I can't help the throat clearing. That's just going to be going on. Because I don't want to create the distraction of trying to work the cough button constantly for the next, what is it now, 45 minutes? that could be distracting. It's like distracted driving with, you know, with a cell phone. You have a cell phone up to your ear and drive at the same time. It's illegal everywhere, I guess, now. So, the last time that we were live on the Hard Starboard Radio Network was, as I alluded to earlier, December 23rd. 2017. And I don't remember what the topic of that program was, although I'm sure at least part of it was Trump related. Oh, I think the GOP had actually managed, Congress had actually managed to do something, passing what I dubbed the Unaffordable Tax Act, which, because it wasn't accompanied by spending cuts. There's never going to be spending cuts in Washington, D.C., and that's why the whole thing's going to collapse. It's just a question of when. But it did include a corporate tax cut, which is long overdue. And, you know, it's helped Trump in the polls. He's up about 3 points, and it's helped the GOP in the generic congressional ballot. My projections now, they still show the GOP losing the House, but by a razor-thin margin, as opposed to a month ago when it was over, well, upwards of 60 seats. So they've helped themselves. They'll screw it up. Trump will screw it up. That's just the nature of Trump. But December 23rd, that was the day after we got our new kitty. The new mascot for this program, Reese's Peanut Butter Cat. I used to be able to carry a tune one time. We had just gotten our new cat to replace the late S'mores the Wonder Kitty. Oh, I still have that audio clip on my queue here. Let me find it here. S'mores the Wonder Kitty. Actually, Reese's is more along these lines.
Feed me!
Are you that damn hungry right now, kitty?
Yeah.
That pretty much sums up Reese's Peanut Butter Cat. She's definitely food motivated, although she's not fat and slovenly like Mitty. No, she's young and vital. She'll be fat and slovenly later on in her life, but although not if we keep her on a strict diet, which the vet told us to do. Oh, you're feeding her too much. Okay, well, fine. But boy, she the only time Reese's gets affectionate is when she wants to eat. And then she's the most affectionate cat you've ever seen. And once she's fed, and off she goes on her way. So she's not a cuddle bug like S'mores the Wonder Kitty was. Anyway, we'd just gotten Reese's previous day. And then December 23rd, which was a Saturday, I did the last live episode of this program for today. And then the next day was Christmas Eve. And, of course, the intern Missiest and intern Hapless Aide were up here to spend Christmas with us. That's a transition we've made. We don't go to parents' houses for holidays because now our parents are all dead. We are... excuse me. Told you. Be prepared. Instead, our kids, our grown kids, now come to us. So they were coming up. Pardon me again. And they did come up. I think they went to spend some time with one of intern Missius' friends up here, high school friends. And so that provided me the opportunity to do the program I would have done on Friday if we hadn't been out getting Reese's Peanut Butter Cat. And so I concluded that podcast, and then we did whatever we did on Saturday, and then Sunday we all went to church, and then we were going to visit my dad, since it was Christmas Eve, spend some time with him over at his nursing home. And now, understand, in the context of this, I'd gotten a call, two, 3 days earlier that hadn't been eating, hadn't been wanting to eat, and he'd been throwing up every other day. And so that was a cause for concern. But then early Friday morning, I got a call saying, oh, he's feeling better, and he's wolfing down his breakfast this morning. So, it seemed like, okay, well, he had a 24-hour bug or something, and now he's better, and so I didn't think any more of it. And then, of course, we got to Sunday, and then we get a call from the nursing home saying, "Oh, well, he's not eating again, and we're worried about him. He doesn't look like looks like he's in pain." And so I said, "Well, we're on our way over there anyway, so let me take a look when I get over there, and then I'll decide what to do from there." So we got over there, and he indeed did not look well, so I told the caregivers, call the EMTs, just get him to the hospital, because it's always the same thing with Dad, or was always the same thing, another urinary tract infection, because he has, of course, his bladder doesn't work anymore, so he can't pee, and he has a urinary catheter, and any buddy with a urinary catheter. The legacy of urinary catheters is one urinary tract infection after another. You can do everything you can do to combat it, to reduce it, to minimize it, but you can't eliminate it completely. You're going to get urinary tract infections. Now, when you're younger, maybe it doesn't matter all that much. It's a nuisance. It's a pain in the butt. But when you're 84 years old and bedridden and feeble, then, yeah, it becomes a bigger deal. So we don't take it lightly. So whenever that happens, we call 911 and make sure we get them to the hospital. So that's what we did in this case. Great thing to be doing on Christmas Eve. You know, taking my dad to the hospital. Great thing for him, having to go to the hospital on Christmas Eve. But we did what we had to do. And so he was admitted. And then, of course, we had Christmas on, Christmas Eve was on a Sunday, so on Monday we had Christmas. And then the next day, the 26th, I spent all day over at the hospital. And ran a best of show from there, because that week I ran best of shows on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. A week of Jazzmius on KCAA and KMET, right? And a live podcast we're supposed to resume the day, you know, the following Tuesday, the day after New Year's Day, January 2nd, 2018. That was the original plan. It looked like it was going to be that. Because according to the doctor that I spoke to, he said, well, we figure he'll probably be in here a week, and then he'll, you know, the infection will be brought under control, and then I'll go home. So, okay, no problem. Should be able to resume podcast, business as usual, the following Tuesday, January 2nd, 2018. And then the next day, on Wednesday of New Year's week, the inter-holiday week, I get another call from the hospital, or I get a call from the hospital. It was the first of many, as it turned out, indicating your dad's taking a turn for the worse. You better get down here. Apparently, his blood pressure and pulse had collapsed, and so they put him on dopamine again. Now, bear in mind that this is not the first time he'd been hospitalized for a urinary tract infection, and it was not the first time that he'd been put on dopamine to support his blood pressure and pulse. And so we went down there, and Mrs. Hart Starboard and intern Gerhard, because intern Missius and intern Hapless Aid had gone home. And and then, you know, he was unconscious, and he was had every tube and IV and needle known to man jammed into some part of him. But he was still alive. He wasn't in good shape, needless to say, but he was still alive. And so, as it turned out, would be more or less a condition that he would remain in for the remainder of his life, the remaining few weeks of his life. But we didn't know that at the time, you see. Because the previous time, a year and a half ago, that he'd been in the hospital and a similar condition, but not this bad, of course. He was in for about two and a half weeks, but he never lost consciousness that time. He was able to eat, drink. I mean, he had limitations. He had dysphoric limitations, so he couldn't just eat and drink regularly, but they regulated what he could eat and the thickness of drinks and so forth, but in this case, he was completely unconscious. He was out of it. So he was worse than he was a year and a half ago. And thus began a process of the doctors doing everything they could within the boundaries of my father's DNI, DNR form, do not revive, do not intubate. He didn't want a feeding tube. And the limits of what they believed that my dad could tolerate. They didn't want to put him under general anesthesia, for example, because they didn't think he could survive it. He was that weak and that feeble. So they did do a couple of things over the ensuing 2 weeks. They did a nephrostomy, where they stick a tube into your kidney to drain out pus and sediment and blood and such. And they did that in his right kidney, or no, the left kidney. Is that right? Yeah, left kidney. But that didn't... See, it wasn't just that he had an infection. It was that the infection was coming not necessarily from his bladder or his urethra, but from his kidneys. His kidneys had gotten infected. And kidney specifically, more specifically, the kidney stones had gotten infected. And so they removed several of them from his left kidney with a nephrostomy, but the right kidney still had the same problem. They were full of infected kidney stones, and that was just kept pouring more infection into his bloodstream. That's what they call toxic sepsis, because the kidneys are kind of like the sewage treatment plant of the body. And so if your kidneys aren't working, then you got a problem. And I speak as someone with low level chronic kidney disease, so. I know whereof I speak on that. Even have my own nephrologist, as a matter of fact. It's a source of my high blood pressure, just for the record. But they eventually put in a stent into his right kidney. You see, there were stones that were large enough that they couldn't remove them arthroscopically, and they said that the only other thing they could do is remove his right kidney. And I said, well, no, you're not going to carve him up like a roast at this point. And besides which, they said, well, they didn't do it. They weren't going to do it anyway, because they didn't think he could take general anesthesia. So they put in the stent, and that turned out to be sufficient. Once they had taken the stent and gotten out as much pus and blood and so forth as they could, then the antibiotics started beating back the infection. His white blood cell count, which had been hugely elevated, gradually returned down to normal. And they were even able to get him off the dopamine. His blood pressure, his pulse, his system worked without the dopamine. And so... theoretically, he was on the way to recovery, except he never really recovered. And this is the thing that I observed for the entire month he was in the hospital. I'd go over there almost every day, and he never regained consciousness. I mean, now, after the stent was put in, he was a little bit more, he seemed to be awake. But he wasn't lucid. He would mumble. He would... he'd make these noises that were just... you knew he wasn't right. I mean, he was semi-conscious, but... And if you... It's like you had to drill down to find his lucidity, his consciousness. I likened it to being trapped under a frozen pond, and you're trying to get to the... a punch through the ice to... get your head above water, and it just was very difficult to do. I mean, you could drill down sufficiently that you could ask him questions, and he knew who he was, he knew where he was, he knew when it was, or at least when it was when he got into the hospital. And he even mentioned to one of the nurses, so I was told, that his granddaughter is a teacher. She is. But he never got back to full normalcy. He was, he'd mumble, and he would, like, one day I went in and I said, "Hi, Dad." And he said, "Hi, Jim." And then he spent all afternoon saying, "Hi, Jim, hi, Jim, hi, Jim, hi, Jim, hi." And I tried to picture what it was like inside his head. What was, he experiencing? What kind of delirium? What kind of perception? I couldn't imagine. It was like he was delirious, even though at that point he didn't have a fever. And he never came out of it, ladies and gentlemen. He just never did. And, you know, they understand, this is a man that over the past 12 years had endured what more than any man should ever have to endure. He broke his hip replacement. 2 years later, he had to have the other hip replaced. Because if you don't get the first one just exactly right and aligned with the other hip, then it creates problems with leg length and gait and so forth. And he wore his other hip down to bone on bone, so it had to be replaced. And year after that, he was diagnosed with colon cancer and had to have part of his colon removed, and chemo and arthroscopic removal of one of his adrenal glands, and a 2-year battle, but he beat colon cancer. My dad was a cancer survivor. And then, of course, the following year, my mother passes away in 2011, and he's the one that found her body in a front yard. I just listened to my tribute to my mother from September 10th, 2011, on the Old American Daily Review podcast, just to reacquaint myself with it. And I can't imagine a bigger nightmare than to find your wife's corpse while you were out doing whatever you were doing, what my mother used to refer to as gallivanting around town. He was probably at the library reading newspapers or wherever. He's the one that found her dead. And I'll tell you what, that changed him. That really changed him, which I'll get to before the end of the program today. And so then he lived by himself independently for almost 4 years. That was probably the most stable time of that 12-year period. But then June 24, 2015, he fell down, passed out. It turned out he had spinal meningitis growing or as a complication of the aforementioned loss of bladder function, so he couldn't pee, and he had never thought to mention that to me, and I didn't notice, or I would have gotten him to the hospital. So he had spinal meningitis, had to undergo a laminectomy, and that was the beginning, really, of the end, because he needed to go into assisted living. And then 8 months later, Mrs. Hart Starboard and I moved him over here near Hart Starboard Galactic Headquarters, and AKA over to Western Washington, close to where we live. And then he only lasted in assisted living about 8 months, and then his level of care that he needed was above what even they could provide. Then I had him hospitalized to try to find out if there was any specific reason why he was continuing to get weaker and weaker and weaker, and they couldn't find anything. It was just, but he did have another urinary tract infection. It turned out that was really the process that ultimately killed him. And then after that stint in the hospital, he had to go into a nursing home. So I found him an adult family home about, 10 miles from where I'm sitting at this very moment. And then the last year and a half, his catheter got completely plugged up about a month later. He had to go back in the hospital with the aforementioned 2.5-week stint with toxic sepsis. His kidneys had shut down, and they got him going again. And he recovered from that. He beat all of that. He had endured all of that. And in the last year and a half of his life, he spent bedridden within four walls, unable to do anything except lay there and watch TV, eat, sleep, and miss my mother. And we visited him. you know, between Mrs. Hart Starboard and I, we visited him multiple times a week, spent time with him. I used to get him, you know, he'd see a burger commercial and he'd say, can you get me one of those? And I'd bring him one. Whether it was a Whopper or a Jumbo Jack or Subway's recent Reuben sub promotion. He liked Reuben subs. I'd bring him Reuben subs. Who knows? That might have contributed to the kidney stones. I really don't know. But, you know, you did what you could for him. We spent time with him, but at the same time, I had a front row seat for this whole process, and I knew he was deteriorating, and I knew that he was slowly dying, and it was just a question of when. And in the meantime, he was suffering a great deal. The indignity of being completely incontinent, completely helpless, and, you know, pain in his extremities that no longer worked, but he could still feel pain from them. And the recurring urinary tract infections, including the one that finally finished him off. And, you know, I looked at that and I felt for him. I wished, you know, there's something he said to me a little over 2 years ago. I had taken him down to prompt care or urgent care with a UTI, and I remember him saying, and I don't know if he was saying this to me or just muttering this to himself, but he said, I wish I could die. Because he felt helpless, he felt useless, and he felt like, what am I still doing here? Why can't I go home to be with the Lord? Why can't I go be reunited with Mariel? It's my mother's name. It's just like he was just marking time. He was just laying around, literally waiting for the next UTI and the next hospital stay. And, you know, it's like you don't want your father to die, but by the same token, you can understand why he wanted to. But the thing that I mentioned earlier that I listened to my mother's, the podcast I did in tribute to my mother, when she passed away on September the 5th, 2011, she went quickly, like a pinched candy wick, just clunk. And she had always said that when her time came, she wanted to go quickly. She didn't want to lay around, wasting away, losing vitality, no longer being the person that her loved ones knew and remembered. She wanted to go quickly. She didn't want to be a burden. She didn't want to, you know, she didn't want to suffer. She wanted to go quickly. And she did. Like that. Dad was the diametric opposite. He didn't go quickly. He took a very long time to die in the big picture. Long, slow, inexorable, agonizing, drawn-out decline. I mean, when he went into hospice care after the hospital, you know, they'd done all they could for him, and he still wasn't bouncing back, wasn't improving. I mean, his blood pressure and heart rate were normal, but his white blood cell count was back to normal, but he wasn't recovering. And so they recommended hospice care, and we went that route, and he went home, and 5 days later, he passed away. Then about 3.5 weeks of my uncle passing away, and my other uncle passed away earlier last year, so there's been a lot of death lately in my family. And he was finally at peace. And I look at that and I think, you know what, I'm next. And I think I said it in my tribute to my mother 6.5 years ago that, you know, there are arguments to be made in both ways, go quick or long, drawn out process. I think I'd rather go quickly myself. Not prematurely. Not prematurely, but, you know that expression of Harvey Dent, Aaron Eckhart's character in The Dark Knight, when he says, you can either die the hero or live long enough to become the villain. Well, this is kind of like that. You know, you can go quickly, not prematurely. No one wants to die before their time. But you can go quickly, or you can go long, drawn out, painful. I think I'd rather go quickly myself. I really would. Because the effect it has on your loved ones is that basically you've already died. You're just, it's not technically true, but for all intents and purposes, you're already dead. I mean, you're not yourself anymore. You're not responsive. You're just, you're beeping, your beeps on a, and squiggles on a screen. It's basically all you are at that point. You're never going to recover, yet technically you're not, your body isn't dead yet, but you've pretty much already checked out. I agree with my mother. I'd rather go quickly. And Dad didn't, and he suffered immensely. But now he's finally at peace. Now, he wasn't always that way. Enfeebled, helpless. Quite the opposite. He was born October 16, 1933 in Springfield, Ohio, to Oscar Sondergeld and Louise Marie Yeager Sondergeld. He was actually their second child. Their first one, Herman, having died in infancy 3 years earlier. Now, my dad did not have an easy childhood. I mean, his parents were older, for one thing. Second of all, they were German immigrants, so a little bit of a culture thing there. When he was 4 years old, he actually visited Nazi Germany with his parents. It was right between the Anschluss, the German annexation of Austria in 1936, and the Sudetenland crisis in 1938. So they went over on an ocean liner in 1937. That's where he came to understand German but still not be able to speak it, which I never did understand that distinction. But what are you going to do? When he was in first grade, my dad came down with a severe case of pertussis, or whooping cough, that caused him to be held back a year because he was out of school for so long that school year. So, you know, he not an easy childhood, and then, of course, grew up during the Depression and then World War II. But in the midst of all that, he found the time to be in Boy Scouts, and he actually became an Eagle Scout, as a matter of fact. He was a competitive swimmer. Excuse me, an ice skater. In fact, he competed nationally at the National Boy Scout Jamboree in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, in, I believe, 1950. I don't remember if he won or not, but my dad was quite the athlete. It was also 1950 that my grandfather, his father, died when my dad was in high school, which is why my dad never graduated high school. Now, he did get what would today be called a GED, General Equivalency Degree. And, you know, you lose your father when you're in high school. That kind of sucks. But he had to drop out of high school so that he could help support his mother, my grandmother, Louise. And then after he got his GED, or I don't know exactly when he did get his high school equivalency degree, but he did enlist in the United States Air Force. As it happens, it was the month after the end of the First Korean War, July 1953. He was in the Air Force active duty 1953 to 1957, the height of the Cold War. And then in the reserves from 57 to 61. He was a mechanic. That's the trade that the service taught him. He was a mechanic for the Strategic Air Command. He helped maintain the B-52 Stratofortress nuclear bombers, as it happens. And by the way, if you've ever seen a picture of my dad and you see he has a receding hairline, well, he always had a receding hairline. And it was because of, ultimately, of the uniform regulations of the military and where he was stationed. He was stationed in places like San Antonio, Texas, and in Mississippi. And the uniform regulations required airmen, enlisted personnel, to wear hats at all times. Well, San Antonio, Texas, Mississippi, very hot, very humid. And it just so happened that my dad was always a heavy perspirer. He sweat a lot. So he literally, by having to wear a cap at all times, he literally sweat off half the hair on his head. That's why he had a receding hairline for the rest of his life. He was also stationed at Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage, Alaska, again, Strategic Air Command, nuclear bombers, and at Larson Air Force Base in Moses Lake, Washington, where on a weekend pass in, I believe, 1955, he went up to Wenatchee, which was only an hour away, to go roller skating, and that's where he met my mother, the former Mariel Aiden. And that's also where he quit. He lost his smoking habit. He quit smoking because my mother told him, "You're going to be hanging around me. Those coffin nails have to go." And he quit cold turkey. I mean, nicotine may be addictive, but it didn't affect my dad that way because I guess my mother was more addictive to him than nicotine was. They were married the following year, 1956. When he got out of the service, he went to trade school to add to his mechanical skills and then went to work for Rayhard Appliance in Wenatchee, where he worked until 1969, and then he went to work for the Wenatchee School District, where he remained until his retirement in 1995. Now, that seems like a bare-bones bio of my dad, but there's... Let's give a little bit more flavor to it, shall we? See, understand, this is his eulogy. Because speaking to the pastor over at Calvary Bible Church in Wenatchee, same place my mother's memorial was and where my folks attended for decades, and he said that given the fact that everybody that my dad knew had either passed away or in nursing homes now, if we held his memorial service over there, it would be sparsely attended. And I said, well, that kind of sucks. I don't want to do that. So whereas my tribute podcast to my mother was the rough draft of my eulogy at her memorial, this is the eulogy, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to have a graveside service at Tahoma National Cemetery, but not a separate memorial service. So this is the eulogy, just so y'all understand that. Now, my dad was from the greatest, or the tail end of the greatest generation. You know, the generation where men didn't express their feelings. You know, dads weren't soft and sloppy and, you know, prone to say, "I love you" very much. And so my dad didn't. Now, I don't know what he said to my mother, but I hope he said it to my mother, at least occasionally, but didn't say it to me. And he was kind of tough on me. I mean, my dad and I didn't really get along all that well when I was growing up. My mother had to protect me, not physically protect me, but run interference for me and say, "Now, Ralph, he's just a little boy," and, you know, that kind of thing. That's where I learned the term German temper, like it was a thing. My mother would always say, "Well, he's got that German temper, you know." And I used to think, "Oh, well, Germans have volatile tempers, huh?" Well, it turned out in later years, I actually started thinking about it, and what's so special about German tempers? What about Irish tempers? What about Chinese tempers or Japanese tempers? Or heck, Klingon tempers. I mean, that iron is a temper, right? It wasn't that my dad had a German temper. It's just he had a temper. He was impatient. He was prone to flying off the handle. You know, he would tighten. When things didn't go the way he wanted them to, he would tighten up. Couldn't relax. He couldn't go with the flow. It just wasn't in his nature. Even in later years, when he mellowed to a degree, he still had that tendency. And that wasn't easy to grow up with. I mean, he wasn't abusive or anything like that. Don't get the wrong idea. But he wasn't easy to get along with. Simple as that. I was more my mother's son than my father's son. And but see, he expressed his love in other ways. He didn't do so verbally. He would do so and spend time. Like my dad was an outdoorsman. He would, he would take me camping and backpacking and fishing with my uncle and my cousins. The first time he ever took me fishing was in 1969, when I was 5 years old. We went to a subtly named place called Fish Lake. That's what they called it, Fish Lake, because apparently it was a man-made lake, and they stocked it with fish, because it was landlocked, and there was no streams going in or out of it. It was just a man-made lake, and basically a giant puddle, and they stocked it with fish. And that's, if you wanted to take a beginning angler any place, this was it, because it was the easiest place in the world to fish. And so this is where my dad took me, and he had a boat at that back then, and so he took me fishing. And apparently they had just stocked the place, the lake, because he baited my hook, and he made my cast for me and handed me my pole. And then he was starting to bait his own hook. And I said, what should he hear coming from his 5-year-old son? But, "Dad, I think I have a fish." Turned out I did. So he reeled it in for me and, took it off the hook and threw it in the bucket. And then he baited my hook again and made my cast for me and handed me the pole and went back to baiting his pole, and what should he hear like 30 seconds later? But, "Dad, I think I have another fish." So the process repeated itself and repeated itself and repeated itself. Now, I'm sure that he must have gotten some fishing of his own in, but my recollection is that I just kept catching one fish after another, and he never did get a chance to get a line in Fish Lake. I think I caught 11 fish that day, and that's probably 90% of all the fish I've ever caught in my life. Now, I'm not an outdoorsman. I still have my fishing pole, just like I still have my skis, for all the good that does me. But, he took me fishing. He took me camping, took me backpacking. It's on the family home videos from those years with my dad and my uncle and my cousins and I. And, he would always take me with me on his annual vacation, which really wasn't a vacation, because every year he would take 2 weeks in the summer, fly back to Ohio, where my grandmother still lived, Springfield, Ohio. In fact, at that time, she lived in the house next to the house in which he was born, October 16th, 1933. And he'd always take me with him. It was our man trip. That's what we used to call it. When the men, "We are men, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, we are men." It was our man trip. Every year, Dad and I would go back to Ohio and help Grandma out, make all the repairs and, fix things and get the oil changed in her car, her vintage 1963 Chevrolet Corvair. You know, the kind of car that had the gear shift on the dashboard, this little knob that you would move up and down. And you know, he'd always take me with him, which was a gigantic pain in the ass for him, I'm sure. Because he had to worry about keeping an eye on me to keep me from getting into things or wandering off or getting in trouble. It was the kind of thing that he would leave for my mother ordinarily, and she would take care of, but not in that case. He was responsible for me, and so he'd always take me, never said a word about it, never said, oh, can you leave him home? And nope, he always took me along with him. And every year as part of that vacation, he would take me to Kings Island Amusement Park in Cincinnati, Ohio. Yeah, it had, it was kind of like a poor man's Disneyland, shall we say. And he would take me there and he'd take me on the rides, and you know, I had a lot of fun. I have no idea what it was like for him, probably a gigantic pain in the ass. But I had fun. He took me without hesitation, without complaint. And in fact, one time I recall vividly that we always took Grandma's car down to Cincinnati. It was like an hour's drive away. So Springfield was surprisingly centrally located in the state of Ohio. But an hour away from Dayton, an hour away from Cincinnati, an hour away from Columbus. I mean, it was in west central Ohio, as it happens. One year we were on our way down to Kings Island when Grandma's car blew a gasket and oil was pouring directly into the engine block. And it had the effect of generating what, to my 10-year-old eyes, were gigantic clouds of black smoke that obscured entire city blocks. Now, I'm sure it wasn't quite that bad. It was just a little 1963 Chevrolet Corvair, but that's my 10-year-old recollection of it. And I happen to think that that was hysterically funny. I laughed my little 10-year-old ass off at the spectacle of that, which I'm sure pissed Dad off to no end, because he was the one that had to, now I gotta fix this, and it shoots the whole day to blistering hell, and how much is this gonna cost, and all the things that adults think of, and that I certainly think of as an adult, but I don't remember him getting mad at me. I don't remember, you know, he was willing to spend time with me. He was willing to take me along. I remember another time, we hadn't left home. Well, see, we would come over to my uncle's house in Renton, over here in Western Washington. He'd leave his car there, and then my uncle would drop us off at SeaTac Airport, and then he'd pick us up, and we came back. We'd just gotten over here, and I don't know whether my dad forgot to put it in his 1968 Ford Galaxy in park. I don't know if he'd forgotten to do that, or if he hadn't put on the emergency brake, or if both of those items were damaged. I don't know what the proximate cause was, but we were in my uncle's front living room. And we could see my dad's car from out the front window. And I wasn't really paying all that close attention. And they were chatting, my uncle and my dad were chatting about something. But all of a sudden, my uncle pipes up and says, "Holy crap, Ralph, there goes your car." Looked out the window, it was rolling down his driveway toward an embankment. Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's almost impossible to imagine seeing my dad the past year and a half bedridden and feeble. It's very difficult to imagine him moving as fast as he did in that moment. I have never seen my father move that fast in my entire life before or since. But he was like the Flash going out the door trying to run after that car. Didn't get there in time, of course, but it didn't go all the way over the embankment. It got kind of high-centered because it wasn't moving that fast. It was just slowly coasting, but turned out it was okay. My uncle had a tow truck, and as it happens, and so he towed it back up the driveway, and it wasn't damaged, but boy, boy, did my dad, I remember he was just, my God, well, I dodged a bullet there. I mean, imagine being over there and your car is in the shop right as you're about to fly back, you know, across the country for 2 weeks. I don't know what we would have done if there had been damage to the car. I suppose we would have come back and then dealt with it. I have no idea, but, or maybe my uncle could have fixed it, but then, you know, fixing it and how much is that going to cost? All the things you remember when you think about when you're an adult, but, you know, he didn't know how to handle stress very well, but he never took it out on me, at least not if I hadn't caused it, like the time that I put a scratch in the side, the chrome, of that vintage 1968 Ford Galaxy. Yeah, believe it or not. Remember, I've mentioned on the air before that I did in my tribute to my mother that I totaled a rental car in 2002. Well, I didn't total my dad's car, but I did put a scratch in it under very, shall we say, irresponsible circumstances. I was 15 years old. Now, understand, this is another example of my dad spending time with me and indulging me. From when I was practically in the crib, I wanted to drive. Driving, when I was a little kid, was what sex became after I passed puberty. You know, borderline obsession. I wanted to drive so bad. Nothing was cooler than driving. I couldn't wait to get to 16 so I could get my driver's license. I used to, you remember those old lawn dart games? They can't sell things like that these days, but you know, the lawn darts where you'd have the plastic thing that you'd connect into a circle and you put them out in the yard and you throw these metal darts and you throw it and you try to make them land inside the circle. That's how you scored points. Well, I used one of those. Every time my folks and I went anyplace, I sat in the back seat with that one of those plastic circles and pretended I was steering, pretended I was driving. I couldn't wait to get my driver's license. I couldn't wait until I was 16 and old enough to drive. Well, I finally reached age 15 and a half. In my sophomore year of high school, I was going to take driver's ed. So like in August of 1980, my dad took me out to the DMV to get my learner's permit. Now, all you had to do to get your learner's permit was pass the vision exam. Well, the year before, I had gotten glasses. And apparently, my eyes were still deteriorating at an alarming pace. And so when I went to get my learner's permit and I took the vision exam, it turned out I didn't pass. You have to be at least 20/40. And they said I was 20/60. So I didn't get my learner's permit. Now, from an adult perspective, you think, well, no big deal. You go and you get a new prescription and you get new glasses. You go back, you try it again, and you get your learner's permit, and everything's fine. Well, I remember I was 15 years old, so I was impatient. Because when you're a kid, you think, it'll never happen. You know, you're very impatient. You don't have any perspective. Everything is a crisis, kind of like our politics these days. Yeah, that's a topic for another day. And so I was indignant. I didn't have anybody to be mad at. Nobody had done this to me, but it just seemed like, it's not fair, it's not fair, it's not fair. Also sounds like our politics these days. And so I decided, you know what? I'm going to go out and drive anyway. Now, I wasn't contemplating, you know, driving up Leavenworth or driving around town or anything. I was just going to wait till my dad was at work and my mother was out shopping, and this is still summer, so I was home, okay? And then I was going to get in my dad's vintage 1968 Ford Galaxy, drive it down the street to a parking lot, turn around, bring it back, put it right back where I found it. Who would ever know? Famous last words, as my mother used to say. Now, understand, I did this. I wasn't there. No insurance. Can you imagine if I'd hit somebody? What that would have done to my, well, would have cost my parents their automotive insurance. But I went out, no experience, never drove before, not on insurance, unlicensed, and I wasn't even wearing my inadequate glasses. Got on the car, but I drove it down to that parking lot, turned around, brought it back, so that part was fine. Here was the problem. My dad had backed it into the driveway, so that's what I had to do. Now, understand that I am a good backer-upper. I've always been a good backer-upper. I didn't know that then. Also understand this. My dad had put a gigantic rock at the end of the driveway because he didn't want... My mother's flower beds were there, and he didn't want people turning around in his driveway and, oh, by the way, running over my mother's roses. I don't know if they were prize roses, but they were roses nonetheless. So I had to back up into the driveway. Never done it before, and I had to navigate around this great big-ass rock at the end, right next to the driveway at the end of my parents' flower bed. Or my mother's flower bed. Now, I did get it into the driveway, but I didn't quite navigate it around the big ass rock. In the process, putting a big scratch into the chrome on the driver's side door, or driver's side doors, of my dad's prize 1968 vintage Ford Galaxy. Now, I had just got it about where I thought it had been when my mother got back from shopping. She asked me, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, so of course, what did I do? I panicked. I'm 15 years old at this point, remember? No excuse, but still, I was 15 years old. So I panicked and I made up the biggest cock and bull lie that I could think of in the moment. I said, "Well, yeah, I was in the car, and I took it out. I was pretending to drive, and I took it out of gear, and it started rolling forward. So I was putting it back in place." Well, see, now my mother, I don't know if my mother bought that or if she just decided not to make a big deal out of it. I don't know why, because anybody who had looked at that driveway would have realized that that is an absolutely level driveway, so if you took it out of gear, it's not going to coast anywhere. In fact, if anything, that driveway tilted slightly away from the street, not toward it. But, again, either my mother really didn't have any concept of spatial geometry, or she just didn't think anything of it. At any rate, while my mother may have bought that, my dad didn't. Took him 3 days, if this was like on a Tuesday or Wednesday, took him to the end of the week to notice that scratch. When he did, oh my God. It's like, Krakatoa! He blew his stack. And from my 53-year-old perspective, I can't really say that I blamed him. He was absolutely livid. That was the time, I believe, that he said, "I ought to hit you up the side of the head with this." He was referring to a fireplace poker. He never did. Don't worry, he wouldn't have. But he was pissed. Now, my mother punished me. I don't remember how long the grounding was. But I tell you what, if it had been me, I would have been twice as pissed as he was at me. You know, your son takes your car out, puts a dent in it, risks his life, God knows how many other lives, other drivers, could have been in an accident. Stupid, stupid, stupid. But like I say, my dad was easier as pissed off as he was easier on me than I would have been. in his place. You know, my dad did things for me. He spent time with me. He didn't tell me he loved me, but he did things for me. And, you know, I didn't really appreciate that as much as I should have or recognize it for what it was. Like, he recorded my senior stage band concert, the last stage band concert in high school. He recorded that. Tape didn't even last the next decade, but broke like 1991, so I don't have that recording. It was a Kmart special. What do you want? But he did that for me. When my folks got me my tenor saxophone so I could play in stage band. Even back then, that was a $700 or $800 purchase. He never complained, never said a word about it. Didn't even think to quit. It never occurred to him to question it. I was his son. Same thing with their mostly putting me through college. I was the first college graduate in my family. Never heard any complaints from my dad about it. This is no small endeavor either, as I can speak to from having partially put my airport intern Missius through college. You know, he showed his love in other ways, in nonverbal ways that I didn't appreciate until later years. And, you know, and then you move away from home and you're not around your parents, you know, you're on your own, and you don't really think about the fact that they're getting older, and then you have kids, and then you become a parent, and then that changes your perspective, and you still don't really think about your parents all that much, other than to realize, they're in their 60s now, they're in their 70s now, you know, and that gets you to place that I was on Labor Day 2011 when I found that my mother had suddenly died at age 76. My dad was not yet 78. He was about a month and a half, like 6 weeks away from his 78th birthday. And the funny part about that was that after my mother passed away, that's when my dad started expressing his love for me verbally. Every time, I visited him once a month over in Wenatchee. And then after he was living over here close to us, I visited him several times a week. And each and every time, when it came time for me to leave, he would tell me that he loved me. Each and every time. He would say, I wish you lived over here closer to me, or I wish I lived over closer to you. Well, he couldn't afford to live over closer to us because it cost twice as much for retirement apartments over here as it did over there, which is why he remained over there. But he told me he loved me. Every time I visited, every time it was time to go, he would hug me and he would tell me how much he loved me. Because when my mother passed away, he realized it brought home to him that you could lose a loved one at any time. And it's important to tell them, not just implicitly, not just through actions, but also through words. Now, the actions are more important than words, but the words are kind of a follow-up. And he told me, each and every time I visited, how much he loved me, and I told him I loved him. And it's a funny thing that when he was in the hospital this last time, the Tuesday before he took his turn for the worse and really never came back from, you know, he'd say, I love you, Jim. And I'd say, I love you too, Dad. But on that Tuesday when I left to go home from the hospital, and then the next day he took his turn for the worse, he didn't just say, I love you, Jim. He said, I love you, Jim. I really, 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 really do. He'd never done that before. you know, he would ordinarily he would say, "I love you, Jim," but then he put so much emphasis on it. It was almost as if he realized that this was his last chance to really drive home how much, as his son, his only kid, his only next of kin, how much he loved me. And that stuck with me. You know, now at the time you think, well, okay, maybe this is it. Maybe you don't know. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But in his mind, it's like he suspected this might be it. And so he wanted to overemphasize how much he loved his son. And, you know, I really need to take that lesson as far as telling my wife and my daughter and my son, and saying to me, my son-in-law, how much I love them. Because you don't know when will be the last time that you see a loved one. I mean, remember me totaling that rental car and a set of circumstances that got me out of it with just a scratch. You really never know. But Dad knew, and he told me, and I told him how much I loved him. And thanks to the cross of Jesus Christ, thanks to his dying for our sins, those who know him and their loved ones who know him know, we know that we will see our loved ones again. I will see my mother again at Christ's feet. I will see my dad at Christ's feet as well. When I check in my load, they will be waiting for me. So, maybe it's not goodbye, Dad. Maybe it's see you later.
Back when I was a child, before life removed all the innocence, my father would lift me high and dance with my mother and me, and then spin me around till I fell asleep. Then up the stairs he would carry me, and I knew for sure I was loved. If I could get another chance, another walk, another dance with him, I'd play a song that would never, ever end. How I'd love, love, to dance with my father again. Ooh. When I and my mother would disagree, to get my way I would run from her to him. He'd make me laugh just to comfort me, yeah, yeah. Then finally make me do just what my mama said. Later that night when I was asleep, he left a dollar under my sheet. Never dreamed that he would be gone from me. One final dance with him. I'd play a song that would never. I'd love, love, love to dance with my father again. Sometimes I'd listen outside her door, and I'd hear how my mother cried for him. I pray for her even more than me. I pray for her even more than me. I know.
See you later, Dad. I love you. I really, 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 really do.